Your $25,000 fantasy may come true. It's 7:40. 20 minutes till 8 o'clock. Rise and shine. Mondays. Oh, you love Mondays. 38 degrees. Our Pittsburgh weather for today, cold, a chance of rain, or rain mixed with snow and a high of 45. Minutes from now, Howard Cosell's going to walk right through these doors, and heaven knows what's going to happen. Should be an interesting morning if you have a chance to leave the radio on wherever you're going. Well, Howard's in the next studio, and he's warming up. I mean, everybody warms up. They all backstage do an aria. If you were going to play the violin, you'd limber up your fingers, and Howard warms up like this.
Bum, bum, bum.
No, bum, bum, bum. Howard.
The whole world smiles at me. Bum, bada.
The Righteous Brothers on KQV at 16 minutes before 8 o'clock, here with Bob DiCarlo in the morning, and a special guest. Good morning, Humble.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm fine, sir. Nice to see you.
Welcome to our fair city. Nice to be back in Pittsburgh. I remember it well. 1960. The Bucks are going all the way, and they did.
1960?
You wouldn't remember that, Bob.
No. Oh, yes, I would. I was in college during that time. I read your book, and there's an article where you... there's a part in the book where you mentioned that you were sitting in a... having a difficult time deciding on the direction you were going on the ABC Monday Night Football game, and you mentioned a restaurant.
Vermont.
Oh, yeah. Someone mentioned you had that photographic memory, and that you never...
I had dinner at Lamont last night. I think it's a great restaurant.
It is.
Compares favorably with most around the country and has a glorious view to go with it.
Hope you enjoyed it. Who do you think's going to win tonight?
I think it's a pick'em game. If I had to make a choice, I'd probably go with the Washington Redskins.
You know, Pittsburghers generally, I would say, don't love Howard Cosell, but you...
Why not?
I don't know. You also mentioned in your book that once upon a time we called you and we told you about the fact that the Pennsylvania legislature was up in arms. You didn't mention us on the Monday Night Highlights. I think it's interesting that if you have a chance, you should explain how they pick.
Oh, I've been through that so many times. Really, Bob, in the age of Watergate, with all the travail this country faces, you wonder how grown-up people can get excited over 35 seconds of highlight footage, which I have absolutely nothing to do with. For the 5 millionth time, the highlight games are selected by the producer and the director of Monday Night Football. They speak to NFL Films in Philadelphia. NFL Films takes highlight footage from the games requested by the producer and director. They feed it in. They'll be feeding it in today to the stadium at 4:30 Eastern Time. And on site, as the footage is fed in, I ad-lib over it. That's my role with the halftime highlights. Nor do I, nor does anybody at the American Broadcasting Company have any single thing to do with the Monday night schedule. That is prepared solely and completely by Jim Kensel, the assistant to Alvin Pete Rozelle, who is the closest thing on earth to God, in his opinion, the commissioner of the National Football League.
Well, you go through that whole thing about the way fans behave, and I know it is very difficult times.
I come into this city where I've just read an unbelievable pair of pieces. I hope it's not true. I hope that the people of Pittsburgh in that stadium a week ago did not cheer when Terry Bradshaw was hurt.
Oh, it's true. I had that written down. Isn't that something? I liken it to the Mets fans' treatment of the Cincinnati Reds.
The shame of Shea Stadium has been written ever since the stadium was built. The deportment of the New York Mets fans has always, in my opinion, been at best unworthy, and at worst, much more than that.
I don't know. It's funny how the Pittsburgh fans have behaved since we had a winner. And there's been some pretty interesting things written about it by some of our columnists. We have a couple of good ones. We have a couple of bad ones, too. But the good ones recognize the fact that people get jaded when you get a winner. And if a man is having an off half, off quarter, they actually did. And Joe Green, the other day, just said, you know, he was fed up with the way the fans had behaved. You treat that very well in your book, I think, on just the general reaction to the fan over sports and how they blow it up out of perspective.
Well, there's got to be a mix of balance in life. I suspect that the sports syndrome in this country now today is completely out of balance. And I do dedicate a chapter in my book to what I call the myth of the fan. I think that there's grown up in my whole lifetime, under careful, however unwitting, propagandization by old world sports writers and sports announcers, the curiously implanted notion that if a fan buys a ticket of admission, he carries with that purchase a license to behave in any way he pleases. This, of course, is absurd. The ticket of admission doesn't, and he buys it voluntarily, nobody puts a gun to his head, does not entitle him, and thoughtful people know this, decent people know this, to behave in a disorderly manner, to hurl obscenities out loud that offend the sensibilities and rights of others around him, to hurl debris at a performer on the field, to invade the playing area itself, as happens in many places. No, none of this is part of the purchase of a ticket of admission. And then one must thoughtfully look at the other side of it, Bob, and it's early in the morning and one doesn't want to be terribly serious, I suspect. But one has to be, I also suspect, in a matter like this. In a nation that has been victimized by wars almost endlessly, where young people have been conscripted for the military as a matter of law, where there is possible death, or has been, in an unwanted conflict in Southeast Asia, where they're acutely sensitive to the racial anguish of the country, where they're part of the drug abuse and know all about it because of the tumultuous and turbulent society of which they're a part, where they grapple with the ecology, a word I didn't even know about when I was a kid. Young people growing up that way can't attach the Alice in Wonderland significance to sports that so many people of the past still attempt to do. I find that when a nation is beset by all of those problems, and now Watergate, it's not enough to use as a soothing half-truth the statement, hey, look, we have all these problems, let us escape with a game. Not if that escape results in mass animalistic behavior, which is what's happening more and more in our great stadia. I think there's something sociologically symbolic and disturbing about this kind of fan reaction, and that's what I say in my book.
You maintain it's a game.
What's a game?
I mean that the game is a game. Sport is a game.
No, quite the converse. Sport is big business, pure and simple. The use of the word game is merely generic and a matter of habit and custom and tradition. Professional sport is business, and so is big-time college sport.
You know, when you look at it as an industry,
I mean the contest that takes place within the arena
is a game.
Has to be put in perspective. Nothing is more transitory than a game, and who wins it or loses it.
Are we going to be serious all morning? We're going to have some fun later.
It's up to you. You're the host.
Let's have some fun later. I think I'll have Howard introduce some songs, banter back and forth, and we'll have some fun. Chance of rain or rain mixed with snow today, a high of 45. It's 8 minutes before 8 o'clock. Good morning.
My father married up your chair on me.
Love Me Like a Rock, that's Paul Simon at 3, let's make it 4 minutes past 8 o'clock, 8:04 on KQV. I'm Bob DiCarlo, and today's special guest is Howard Cosell, author of Cosell, which is number 6. on the bestseller list. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Bob.
It's an accomplishment, I think.
It is.
And it's just another indication of your multifaceted life. You're an author. A lot of people don't realize you're a lawyer. I don't think too many people realize that. That you left a budding career as a lawyer to become a broadcaster.
Well, that's true, but I really think by this time a lot of people do know it, Bob.
Well, a lot of people do, and a lot of people probably, you know, somewhere in the back of their mind. How did you get involved in broadcasting, for example? How did it start?
Well, it started when I was practicing law and representing a lot of people in broadcast, including the Television Writers Union, back in the days when television drama was very important, the days of Playhouse 90 and Studio One and all the rest. And one of my clients called me from ABC. I was the attorney for Little League Baseball in New York at the time, and asked for permission to use the name in a six-week summer replacement network radio show that they were going to start. And I gave permission, and then they asked me if I wanted to host it as a hobby. And it stayed on for 5 years, and subsequently ABC offered me a radio deal, which I took. I'd never wanted to be a lawyer. I was the son of Jewish parents who wanted a son who'd be a lawyer. And it was my dad sacrificed a great deal to send me through college and law school. And I thought, owed it to him to become a lawyer, which for me was an easy thing. And but then immediately after admission to the bar and clerking for a year, I went into World War II. And then when I came out, I thought the world was waiting for me because of my military career. And I found out that I had plunged into absolute anonymity and impoverishment. So I opened my own law office and struggled. And still, I wanted a different kind of career. I didn't know quite what. When ABC offered me the opportunity, I grabbed it. Frankly, I would have preferred, as I indicate in my book, that it had been in national and international news, but that was not to be. Circumstance plunged me into the realm of sports, and I've been very fortunate.
Telling it like it is.
Well, maybe I've tried to.
I would say that it's made you a lot of enemies.
Oh, I don't think so at all. Why would you say that, Bob?
Oh!
Who are the enemies?
Probably Mr. Joe Average Superfan.
Quite the converse, Bob. That's one of the things I've pointed out in my book. I've traveled every nook and cranny of this country because in my first year of Monday Night Football, I got all this terrible flack, all this terrible mail, and all this terrible press. And I had to find out for myself. I don't get it at all anymore. And traveling, I've probably spoken at more campuses in the last 3 years than any other single person in the United States. And I haven't found any of that alleged hatred. I think that was an idea carefully propagated by a tiny coterie of sports writers whose feet are firmly implanted in the third century. And I learned in my own growth as a personality in this country that, no. Heavens no, there was no hatred. Now, we set records in every town I go for book signings. As long as I live, I'll never get over Dallas, Texas, and people standing five blocks long in the streets waiting to come in and buy that book for $8.95 a copy, $9 in round figures. And the same thing in Buffalo and in Denver and in Houston and in Chicago and in Cleveland and in Detroit and in Washington. I don't think so at all. Because that kind of thing troubled me. I think the opposite is true. You know, it's a funny thing how images can be propagated. For instance, a fellow named Saul Braun once wrote a very, very favorable profile of me in TV Guide. But the headline was put in by the headline guy, The Voice You Love to Hate. That was seized upon by this tiny coterie of sports writers and duly propagated. But they've lost. I don't know of anybody else who's sought after by Dean Martin, to whom I'm committed for 4 shows this year, Sonny and Cher, Flip Wilson, Bob Hope, and all of the rest. They don't get the ratings. I'm not sitting here as picturized, arrogant, pompous, vain, no. Conceited, a show-off. I am telling it like it is, and the ratings invariably show the fact. So I think that only a tiny little hardcore of old world sports fans over the age of 50 really represent the group
picturized by the old world sports writers who still believe that the full horizons of life are lodged in the lovable ignorance of Yogi Berra and the stagnation of the dugout.
Oh.
Pretty good, right?
I'd say that's rather accurate, too. You know, we have with us Sam Nover, and I would say that Sam probably is among the finer of our sports reporters on the Eastern Seaboard. Sam covers Penguin hockey, does color for Steeler football, and if anybody's well-versed in the Pittsburgh sports scene, I would think that Sam would be. And Sam, would you like to get any impressions from Howard about what he thinks of Pittsburgh sports?
Bob, I should say, may I steal part of your mic?
Sure, steal part. Go ahead.
I should say at the outset that Bob Harper was kind enough to invite me down here to spend some time with you and Howard this morning, and I was supposed to have brought an award of sorts. I thought about it and thought about it all weekend, and I can't think for the man who has everything. I guess you bring nothing, and really that's what I brought.
That's like you, Sam.
Yes, that's very much like me. It's stiff, right, Bob?
Right.
I was thinking, I heard your conversation coming down with Bob, and I found it most interesting, and I've always found you most provocative. I think a couple of interesting points, and one of which Bob touched upon, was the unpopularity, or perhaps the dislike that may grow in the public. And I think I kind of concur with Bob that there may be a lot of people who don't like you. That certainly may have contributed to your success. And the reason for that is, I think many times you take an unpopular viewpoint. The defense of Muhammad Ali,
that caused major enmity around the country.
I'm talking about when you get into a movement or a cause or something you believe very much in. Generally, it's alien to the beliefs of the vast majority of the public. And you see, when you choose an unpopular viewpoint, you will be unpopular. It doesn't make you unsuccessful. It makes you unpopular, and there's a difference.
The last thing in the world you would want, and you're a lot younger than I, is to be popular but wrong on something that matters. As my book points out in the chapters on Muhammad Ali, what is popular is not always right, and what is right is not always popular. I did become a lawyer. I did major in constitutional law. I did edit a major law review in this country, which is the Phi Beta Kappa of law school. On April 28, 1967, at 4800 San Jacinto in Houston, Texas, the Federal Customs Building, Muhammad Ali rejected military induction. Within 30 minutes thereafter, a politically appointed boob of a boxing commissioner in New York State stripped him of his duly acquired heavyweight championship and of his license to fight. In other words, his right to earn his living. All other states, having boxing commissioners, followed suit. There had been no arraignment, no grand jury presentment, no indictment, no trial, no conviction, no appeal to higher court, no appeal to the next higher court, no appeal to the court of last resort, the Supreme Court of the United States, which, with the issues involved, would undoubtedly hear such a case. Most of the nation, most of the sports writers, most of the sports announcers applauded. They knew nothing. They knew absolutely nothing about the guarantees of due process as lodged in the Fifth Amendment. They knew absolutely nothing about the guarantees of equal protection lodged in the 14th Amendment. I did. The man was vindicated. Conservative, liberal, in the Supreme Court, it didn't matter. And what are you going to say? You have to take the right position, because that's the way this country was built. John Fitzgerald Kennedy did not write profiles in Courage about people who were popular in that time. He wrote it about people who took unpopular stands on principle, but whom history proved right, like Daniel Webster. Right now, I'm looking out at some of the Pittsburgh fans who have an absolutely obscene sign. And that's a sad thing to see, leveled at me, because that's their problem, you see. It's not mine. And nobody literate, nobody thoughtful, nobody well-motivated would come parading up a public street looking into this studio where I've come at a very early hour in the morning to service Bob and KQB with such a sign. So you don't take that seriously, and you don't bow to that. You don't honor that. any more than I would honor those ignorant people who, at a time when the whole nation was clamoring for law and order, approved a defiance of law and order in the purest sense, because the Constitution and its multiple amendments are the key to law and order in this country. And yet they, in the main, welcomed what was done to Ali. I hold no brief for Ali other than as a matter of principle. Constitutional law, I never did.
He made you and you made him.
He was a very important part of my career. I freely confess I respect him enormously. I lived with him through all of those years. I saw his skills evaporate through 3.5 years of enforced idleness. Nobody could give those years back to him. Nobody would. But I never saw him waver. I saw him willing to go to jail if that were the ultimate decision. I saw him give up millions of dollars. To me, that's standing up and saying to all the world, this is what I believe.
And as Jimmy Brown said, he really did believe
it. Of course he did. There was no question about it. Question about it in the minds of certain ignorant people who couldn't understand. He could have gone into the Army and had a better deal than Joe Lewis ever had in World War II.
Howard, wouldn't it be a factual statement to say that the adversaries of Howard Cosell, as well as those who have sided with him, have equally contributed to his enormous success? And in that is a question also. Our industry is such that it has been based pretty much on conservatism through the years, and I think it's amazing that somebody from the sports broadcasting industry can become a household word. You may not be, in many people's opinion, the best sports broadcaster in the history of this industry. You are unequivocally the most successful. How and why?
Well, in the first place, when you're talking about the best sportscaster in the history of the industry, you have to get into matters of definition. What is a sportscaster? Is a sportscaster a play-by-play announcer? If that's what you're after, certainly I'd be very far from the best in the history of the industry, because I don't want to be a play-by-play announcer. And I think in the age of television, sportscasters who do play-by-play are in the main parrots. I don't see any mental exercise to that at all. Nearly all are inhibited by the strictures and structure of our industry. At the local level, those who call games for teams are hired by the teams, which I blame my industry for. I think they forsake not just their prerogatives, but their obligations and responsibilities. And that's why, quite rightfully, I think the FCC is investigating that situation. I also agree with Rune Orledge, my boss, that in the years to come, we're not going to have play-by-play announcers on television. I don't think there's much place for them anymore. I don't want somebody telling me there's a one-hop grounder to the shortstop over to first in time. That's absurd and passe. So that, I think, will change. If what constitutes a sportscaster is somebody who's contemporary, who's prepared to take stands on issues, prepared to acquaint the public with the realities of what's going on in sport, prepared to tell the public, look, sport is human life in microcosm. Some athletes do drink. Some do take drugs. There are owners who defy the public interest, couldn't care less about the public. Here are the cases. Here are the examples. Go right down the line. Fight for the rights of our young athletes who are deprived of the opportunity to compete against the Russians. Fight for the rights of our young athletes in the Olympics who are stripped of gold medals at age 15 because of the failure of an Olympic doctor, or our runners who don't get to the starting blocks on time because of the failure of their coaches, or our basketball players who are jobbed out of a victory they've won over the Russians while there's not a single member of the U.S. Olympic Committee there to fight for them, or our pole vaulter, the best in all the world with the world's record, who has his 9 poles confiscated in the dark of night. If that's what you view as being a sportscaster, that's what I view. Only I would call it sports commentation, then I'm very, very proud of what I've done, and I think I've done much to change the state of my industry. Now, with regard to popularity, I can only tell you this. I'm making no case. If people in Pittsburgh, I don't know about the people in Pittsburgh. I've always been very well received here. I like the town. I think the town has done great things with its civic center. Unlike Detroit and Cleveland, I think the inner city problem that is so much a part of the American scene today has been dealt with much better in Pittsburgh than in most other cities I can name. I think that in terms of the football team, it should be a good and important part of the community without the kind of wild fan behavior I've already alluded to. I think Mr. Art Rooney is one of the great gentlemen I've ever known in sport who is concerned with the public interest, who does want to produce a winner. I think Chuck Knoll is one of the most underpublicized, unheralded fine coaches in the National Football League. I think he's done a superb job. I think the Pittsburgh Steelers have an outstanding football team. I also think the Washington Redskins have an outstanding football team. I view it really as a pick'em game tonight. But leaving all of that aside, when you're on the air, my friend, journalism is what I'm after. And there's no reason in the world why there shouldn't be journalism in sport, just as we expect it in every other avenue of human life. And I don't think the question of a couple of fans, whether it's in Detroit, Cincinnati, or wherever, not liking the stand you take, should govern your thinking. The man who pleases everybody pleases nobody, beginning with himself, because he stands for nothing.